This is Which Way LA. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. Later on To The Point, Warren takes on big data in healthcare. Medical records are being digitized on a massive scale. Will it mean efficiency at the cost of patient privacy? But first, the deep-rooted problem of gender and racial bias in the LA Fire Department. Mayor Garcetti has vowed to change the culture of the agency. It's a major consideration as he searches for the city's next fire chief. In November, a superior court awarded a little over $1 million to a black firefighter, Jabari Jumani, in compensation for the 30 years of discrimination he said he endured on the job. Over the previous year, the agency paid out another $1.5 million in bias cases. And from 2006 to 2010, LAFD discrimination and harassment payouts cost taxpayers $17 million. One notable case involved a black firefighter who was secretly fed dog food in his spaghetti as part of a hazing ritual in a firehouse. Over the years, these settlements have sparked reforms, including monitoring by the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and a voter-mandated independent assessor to oversee handling of misconduct complaints. We'll hear from our guests whether these reforms have made a difference. First up, Ben Welsh is a reporter with the L.A. Times and has been covering the LAFD. Welcome to the program, Ben.
Thanks for having me, Barbara.
Now, I just described the situation in terms of dollar figures in discrimination lawsuits, but can you paint us a picture of the L.A. Fire Department as it is now? How white and just how overwhelmingly male is it?
Sure. So the Los Angeles Fire Department has today a little more than 3,200 what they call sworn firefighters, who are uniformed firefighters who've gone through the very rigorous training and selection process to become a firefighter and then make that their career. Of that total, according to the most recent figures published by the City Fire Commission, it's about 50% white and 31% Latino, 12% black, and 7% Asian, which is much more diverse than it was historically in the past. During the period of the civil rights struggles, there was segregation in L.A. City firehouses, and it was overwhelmingly white. And we have seen quite a lot of change in that over time, though it's still not totally reflecting the city, which is about near 50% Latino at this point. Now, women is a different story in that, according to those same reports from the city, the number of female firefighters is just under 3% of that 3,200 total, and that number has remained stubbornly low despite a lot of talk and efforts to raise it over the past 20 years. It is actually almost exactly the same low number it was in 1995 when the issue was raised in a round of reform efforts at City Hall.
Well, as you say, this problem goes back decades. In this recent spate of lawsuits, are they indicative of current problems, or are they just left over from these more troubled times?
Mm-hmm. Well, the lawsuits that we see being paid out in recent months and in the past year that have added up to a big total again, almost all have to do with events that happened numerous years ago. And after this became a major issue at City Hall about a little less than 10 years ago, there was a lot of turmoil, and the department instituted a series of really serious reforms to try to deal with that, that include pushing out a longtime fire chief, the appointment of the city's first black chief, and the creation of a new sort of internal affairs division to better manage investigations and complaints within the department. And what the department will tell you is that those were largely successful and that the lawsuits that we see being paid out in recent times are really a reflection of the period prior to those problems. However, due to the long period of time it takes for lawsuits to work their way through the system, it's really difficult to tell from that measure what the current status is in the firehouse near where you live.
So what have your investigations found? Have these reforms really made a difference?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's difficult to kind of measure. You could see definitely in cases of diversity on the racial question, you've seen a major change. There's the leaders of the department, members of City Hall, they all point to a lot of these reforms as being successful. But it's hard to say as a reporter on the outside exactly what life is like for the average rank-and-file firefighter, because we're really not there.
Ben Welsh with the L.A. Times. Nana Jumfie is a civil rights attorney based in Los Angeles. She represented Jabari Jumani, the black firefighter I mentioned at the beginning of the show, who was just awarded over $1 million for discrimination that he said he faced on the job. Ms. Jumfie also represented a number of others in bias suits against the agency, and it's good to have you on the show.
Thank you so very much. Good to be here.
Now, can you give us a sense of the complaints filed by your clients? What kinds of discrimination did, for instance, Jumaane report?
The kind of discrimination that he reported and that other folks have come to me and reported recently, I mean, even up until this year, are discrimination that is become endemic in the department, dealing with the way, for example, that discipline is meted out, who gets disciplined, who doesn't get disciplined, what reasons are people disciplined for, the nepotism that results in retaliation against those that aren't a part of the club or that don't go along to get along. So it's not so much about are we getting into the department, except with respect to women. I would agree with what Ben indicated earlier. Those numbers haven't really changed, and that struggle still continues. But in terms of the general, like the racial numbers, it's not so much not getting in. It's how are you dealt with once you're there? What efforts are made to prevent you from being the victim of discrimination, the victim of retaliation, the victim of racial or sexual harassment? And from what I've seen working on these cases and talking to folks within the work and file, either at the stations, as inspectors, you know, in various parts of the department, there's still a lot of work to be done when we're talking about how people are treated and the kinds of conditions that people are forced to work in the department today.
So what is the culture like, as you understand it from your clients? And one of your clients really shattered the glass ceiling in the department. Delisa Davies is the LAFD's first Black female firefighter. Tell us about her experience.
Her experience was one where you see the intersectionality of being Black and female. So she dealt with much of what other women in the department have talked about in terms of not being seen really as worthy of being in the department, not being looked at as some, you know, there's, when you talk to people within the department, even about the clerical staff, they will refer to clerical staff members who are women as the girls. So that's if she was six. I mean, to the, you know, 2013. And informal conversations, oh, the girls will do this or the girl was doing that. I'm like, are you talking about the woman? So you can imagine the kind of thoughts that people have about women who opt not to be clerical staff, but to actually go out there and fight fire. And I think that there still is a notion that there's things that are not natural for women to do. So it's not that, you know, they understand that there are women firefighters and that, you know, they're going to have to live with that. They're here. But there's an underlying feeling that they can't do what we guys do, to the point even of driving trucks. You know, when Ms. Davies was trying to be an apparatus operator so she could drive, you know, the fire engine, it was difficult for her to find someone, a captain, who at that point were men, basically, who would allow her to practice with a truck. You know, really, she was literally told to her face, no, ain't no girl going to ride my truck. I'm not lending my truck out to a girl to ride. And this notion that, hey, you're not worthy, this is not a place for you, is one that she has dealt with. I mean, she was a firefighter in spite of all of her efforts and the work that she has done, and the good, you know, evaluations, excellent evaluations, et cetera. She was a firefighter until a couple years ago. And she's been with the department for 30 years, would pass all the subjective tests to become a captain or to promote. And mysteriously, when it came to the subjective part where they asked you questions, she would become an idiot and not remember anything. According to the department, she would be getting A's on one part and get to the subjective part, and suddenly she's getting a D. And she's unable to move forward. And that's an experience that a lot of women have had. You know, her experience speaks to that. But she's also had the experience that Black folks have had. And I think it's important to point out, if I don't get to point out anything else, that since 1991, the city audits, where it's audited itself in the fire department, has specifically indicated that Black people were disproportionately disciplined as compared to their numbers, like 38%, 40% of discipline when they were 8, 9, 10% of the department. And consistently, the city has said, that doesn't look right. We need to look into this. And consistently, they've never looked into this. And that's one of the things that came out in firefighter Jumaane's case, that there has been, and one of the things the jury found, is that there is systemic discrimination on policy levels. And that goes beyond just who are you hiring.
Ben, what has the department said about these discrimination cases?
Well, the department has an interim fire chief now, James Featherstone, and one thing he said is he's really focused on the recruiting effort for the next class of firefighters who will be welcomed in this coming year. And he said that their current efforts to try to recruit women and minorities were, in his words, embarrassing, and that the department needed to be, in his words, again, much more aggressive about pursuing quality candidates from different backgrounds. And he even suggested that the department should consider outsourcing the effort to try to draw people in rather than running it in-house.
Captain Frank Lima is the president of the United Firefighters of Los Angeles, the union representing rank and file firefighters. Captain Lima, welcome to the show.
Hey, well, thank you. Thank you very much, Barbara. Happy to be on the show. Thanks.
Now, our guests on this program so far have been describing a situation of pervasive discrimination in the LAFD and a climate, I guess, of intolerance. How do you respond to that?
It's an interesting topic because, matter of fact, Jabari Jabani, that's a civil case that I actually went and sat in the courtroom in support of that several years ago, I believe almost 10 years ago, or 2006, 2007. And, you know, it is a problem, but it's not as rampant as it's being made out to be, and that's for sure. There's been a lot of changes. The fire department, I have 22 years on the job, and it's changed tremendously for the more positive since I came on, in regards to a department that reflects the community, in regards to just the way people treat each other has dramatically changed. You know, no more throwing buckets of water on top of people and demeaning. It's still there, but the majority of the weeds have definitely been pulled out. I mean, when it comes to fire department, still has some work to do, but as a whole, I think made some great strides with the organization. I mean, we expect our members to act in a professional manner, do their job in a respectful way. I mean, I don't dispute a few of the cases highlighted in the LA Times, but I'll tell you what, not every card out of the 52-card deck was laid out on the table. There are several other cases, such as, you know, I mean, for example, the dog food case. You know, just inexplicable. You know, why did that happen? But you know what? There was management mishiring of tremendously big amount of these cases. For example, the white firefighter that bought the dog food, the captain, ended up suing the fire department because of management's mishandling, and they won because management targets whoever they want to target when the political climate is right. Go ahead.
So if there have been changes, then what do you attribute the changes to? What's working?
Well, you know, I think, just the times are changing. I mean, we have an African-American president of the United States. I mean, a lot of things are changing. I mean, we've had four African-American chiefs in a row, and currently, our UFLAC, our United Firefighters of Los Angeles Board, we have a president, first vice president, first generation firefighters, Latino. Our second vice president is from Vietnam. We have a Colombian who speaks Spanish, and we have a Japanese treasurer. That's just on the top level of our executive board. And, you know, Jim Featherstone, by the way, and these are all elected by our membership. This is something, I mean, you talk about a democratic process. These are, and Jim Featherstone, our fire chief, he's actually in emeritus status, a lifetime member of our union, because he served on the board actually alongside of me years ago, and he's a lifetime status. That's what our general membership reflected of him. So, you know, it goes both ways, but just to make it clear, that our men and women are not out there in the fire station. They don't just sit around and harass one another. That's just simply not the case. Our firefighters and paramedics are out there risking their lives to save others. Just this morning, we had two civilians die at a fire in Echo Park. Our firefighters arrived there in 3 minutes. That's what they do. We rush to emergency situations, do everything we can to save lives. We go to the burn center. Our firefighters are getting hurt. And it's just, this is, it's, we're a department in great perils with staffing right now. We haven't hired a firefighter in 5 years. There's a grand jury report that came out, says that people are dying in the city of Los Angeles. We need to restore to 2008 levels. And it's just, I mean, this is very important, but you know what? If you're going to do this story, lay all the 252 cards out, and there's a lot of other things that go along with this as well.
Captain Frank Lima, president of United Firefighters of Los Angeles. I want to bring in Ben Welsh with the LA Times right now. Ben, can you respond to what Captain Lima is saying? Are things changing, and are they changing in the way that Captain Lima is representing them?
Well, you know, honestly, as a reporter who's here at my desk at the LA Times, it's difficult for me to tell you what life is like in the 106 fire stations spread throughout the city. You know, I think that, you know, I don't think anyone is claiming that there's some sort of constant, you know, horrible harassment that's happening all across the city. But the degree to which things have changed and to be measured, you know, are kind of beyond my tools to evaluate. However, the department did have an independent assessor appointed as part of the reforms near the end of the last decade, who was charged with overseeing how well the department was implementing these reforms. And he issued a number of audits through the years, many of which that cited a lot of progress and said a lot of the same positive things that Captain Lima just told you, but also pointed to some shortcomings in the system and ways it could be improved.
And Captain Lima also mentioned the elephant in the room during this whole conversation, which is the city's troubled 911 dispatch system, the reports of delayed responses to emergencies, and also reports of the agency balking at transparency in dealing with these charges and with this situation. And Ben, you have a new story on this today. What have you found?
Right. Early this morning, the Los Angeles Fire Department's very popular Twitter account was sort of put on, in their words, hiatus. And I was told by department officials that they were going to halt tweeting out details about incidents that firefighters are responding to, like the fire this morning, citing a healthcare privacy law from the 1990s that they had reinterpreted. And that went beyond Twitter. It extended to the public records requests that the LA Times and other media outlets and anyone of the public could make to scrutinize the performance of the department and really try to do an independent assessment of different issues. And that was a big rollback of public records that kind of came out this morning. But now, just moments before, we have this conversation here, I've just been told by LFT that they're going to roll that back again and flop on their flip and say they are going to start tweeting again and they are going to release the information again. So it's hard to really get the story straight, but it sounds like it's all over the map.
Nana Jumpy, just in the last minute of the show, I do want to give you a chance to give us your wish list for a new fire chief. What should a new leader do to put you out of business, to leave you with no clients, at least from the LAFD?
I would love to be left with no clients. I think that the first thing is to remember that when we talk about these firefighters that are putting their lives on the line, as Lima spoke about, that those include Black firefighters, firefighters of color, and women. So it's not that there's these white male firefighters that are putting their lives on the line and everyone else is sitting around thinking of complaints to make. Everyone is out there. And I think that that's something that the fire chief has to remember, that we are, you know, everyone that is signed up for this gig has signed up for the gig because they want to serve the citizens. And as people who are serving the citizens in the way that they are, we need to think about what the conditions are of their work. And so while there may not be a situation going on in every firehouse, I know enough folks have come to me. And this includes white firefighters who have done something that the department does not agree with or that gets on someone's nerves, and then they're retaliated against. They use some other, you know, go back door to handle. So the discrimination needs to be dealt with. The retaliation needs to be dealt with. The processes that are set out need to be followed. Another thing that LAFD is good for, going around the process that they put on paper, so that everyone is protected. And if we can get a fire chief that recognizes that and that is going to follow that and stand firm on that, then I think a lot of the issues that we see are going to disappear.
And Ben, just very briefly, are there other cities that are doing better in terms of hiring more women and minority firefighters? And what's their magic? Mm-hmm.
The reality is that the numbers are low pretty much everywhere across the United States. The nationwide figures, the latest ones that I've seen published by national groups, peg the number at somewhere around 4%, which is, you know, higher than LAFD, but not very much. However, there are a small number of places that have numbers that they can reach up to 8, 9, 10%. And a recent class at a county fire department in Maryland was made up of 14% women. And so there are places where the numbers are definitely higher, but no place is really off the charts.
Ben Welsh, reporter for the LA Times. Nana Jumfie also joined us. She's a civil rights attorney based in Los Angeles. And Captain Frank Lima is the president of United Firefighters of Los Angeles. Thank you all for joining me on the program today.
Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Warren Olney on Which Way LA. Coming up in a moment on Reporter's Notebook on the show, we remember the role California played in pressuring South Africa to free Nelson Mandela.
Subscribe to the Which Way LA podcast at kcrw.com/whichwayla or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find Which Way LA on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Warren Olney on Which Way LA. As the world mourns Nelson Mandela and debates his legacy, George Skelton of the LA Times is reminded of a long-forgotten role California played in Mandela's release from prison. His column yesterday tells the story of how former California Governor George Duke Majan took up the cause of divestiture in South Africa and helped lead the way for the nation, this despite his extreme pro-business and conservative stance on most issues. He even took his old friend Ronald Reagan to task for not coming down harder on South Africa. George Skelton joins us now, and thanks for coming on Which Way LA.
My pleasure.
So help us dial back to the 1980s. Initially, I understand Duke Majan didn't support divestiture. Why not?
Well, he thought the state had a legal responsibility to invest money where it could get the most return. Any very Republican attitude also, you know. Republican governor, and the Republican Party didn't think California should divest in firms doing business with South Africa, just like Ronald Reagan didn't. Reagan was president at the time, and he vetoed a divestiture bill. And incidentally, it was the only bill that he vetoed that was ever overridden. Congress overrode him. But that was after California acted. And Duke Majan was just going along with the flow, really, the Republican flow at the time, but remembered his own family, Armenian family in Turkey that suffered at the hands of the Ottoman Turks. Some were killed, and they lost a lot of property and all kinds of things, and they tried to get out of Turkey, and they couldn't for a long while. And they were kind of helpless, and they finally escaped. Duke Majan's parents finally escaped Turkey and came to New York, actually, and then to California. But he was remembering all that and decided he couldn't live with himself unless he helped the South African blacks, and that's why he changed his mind.
So he made a personal connection. Do you know if there was one thing someone said or something he read that made him change his mind?
Well, he kept reading the newspapers every day, I guess. I mean, there's more and more people being killed in South Africa. And also his chief of staff, had Jewish parents who were killed by the Nazis, and not parents, but grandparents. Steve Merksamer was his chief of staff. His parents escaped to America from Germany. But he recalled all these stories about his family being butchered by the Nazis since they death camps, and he agreed with Duke Majan to begin with, and then they both started talking about it, and they just decided to switch.
So he flip-flopped, Duke Majan, and I imagine that must have really kicked up some dust with his supporters. What kind of flack did he have to deal with?
Right. I mean, it's tough for a politician to flip-flop anyway, and particularly when you flip-flop against your own party and your own political base. It's hard to do and survive sometimes. But at that time, also, the Los Angeles mayor, Tom Bradley, black, was running against Duke Majan for re-election. Duke Majan's running for re-election. And Bradley was beating up on Duke Majan pretty good about not being for divestiture. So a lot of people thought at the time, well, Duke Majan is just doing this to undercut Bradley. But and I even wrote some stuff about that, but looking back on it, that was strictly too cynical a view. Duke Majan really did believe in helping the people who are oppressed and discriminated against, and that's what he did.
George Skelton of the LA Times, it was great talking with you. Thanks for this.
Yeah, thank you. My pleasure.
And that's all the time we have for Which Way LA. I want to thank all of our guests, and also thanks to you for listening. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Warren Olney. And just ahead, the risks and benefits of digitizing medical records. Warren will be back with that story on To the Point.